Hi, I'm Melissa Corkum. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call The Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast, conversations with everyday extraordinary people, people who have conquered, people making a difference in their worlds, brave and beautiful people, but people who in the end are just like you and me. If there's one thing I've learned over the past 10 years, it's about how much I didn't know that I didn't know, and how much I still don't know. Our experiences and adoption and loving kids who have aged out of the foster care system, living in the country but owning a coffee shop in the city, and just traveling internationally have so greatly expanded our horizons and shifted our paradigms. And hopefully, we're better humans for it. The one common theme through all of those experiences, though, was just listening to people's stories. Patty Dye once said, "The shortest distance between two people is a story." So pull up a chair and an open mind and meet another one of my everyday extraordinary friends. Welcome to episode 17 of the Uncorked Podcast. This week, my guest is Kathleen Guire. Kathleen's story really resonated with me because we're on such similar journeys, but she's a couple steps ahead of me, so she had so many tidbits that I wanted to take notes about along the way. She's also the founder of the Whole House blog, whose mission is to equip, educate, and encourage foster and adoptive families. Also, January is National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. This is another cause that Kathleen is really passionate about, and she'll get to talk about her first novel, which is meant to introduce young adults to the dangers and realities of trafficking. Kathleen and I also refer a lot to kids from hard places. This is a term coined by the late Dr. Karen Purvis, and I'll just list the six hard places for you, just so you know a little bit about what we're talking about. So, kids from hard places have either one, come from prenatal stress or harm, two, had a difficult labor or birth, three, experienced early medical trauma, four, experienced another form of trauma, including relationship trauma, which could also be the change of a primary caregiver, which means that all foster and adoptive kiddos fall into these categories, five, neglect, and six, abuse. And so kids could have one or multiple or all of these things. So hopefully that will give you just a little reference point if you're not familiar with the term. So here's my conversation with Kathleen.
Well, Kathleen, welcome to the Uncorked Podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to catch up with you. I've been doing a lot of networking and kind of exploring the social media spaces for other folks, kind of reaching out to people in the adoption world, and I don't even remember how I stumbled upon you, but I'm super glad that we can connect and we have adoption in common. So can you just start out by kind of introducing yourself? Who are you? What defines you? Kind of what do you do day to day?
Okay. So I'll handle each one of those separately. My name is Kathleen Guire, and I have seven children, four through adoption. We adopted a sibling group of four in 2000 from Poland. And as far as what defines me, I gave some thought to this one because I think that truly what defines me is adoption. Because according to Ephesians 1, 4, and 5, before the foundation of the world, God chose me. He actually picked me out as his own, to be his child, to be his girl, because it was his plan from the very beginning that I be part of his family. And that's a lot to think about. That's a lot to swallow, but that defines me. That's what defines me spiritually. And, of course, whatever defines us spiritually, those revelations bleed into our physical life. And because of that, I believe that, and I know that I'm part of God's family, and I know how important that adoption is to him. I mean, adoption precedes the universe. Then I must follow in my father's footsteps and do what he did, and adopt spiritually first and physically second. So that's one of the things that really defines me, and my theology had to become my reality. I couldn't just say, "Oh, you know what, adoption is wonderful, it's great, I believe in it, everyone should do it, but I'm not going to." So it did become my reality. And one of the other things that defined me was I was a child from a hard place myself. And
were you? I didn't know that about you. Are you an adoptee?
I was not adopted. It was my early home life was very disorganized. My father was an alcoholic. So day to day was difficult because I didn't know what kind of mood my dad would be in. One day something would be okay, and the next day it would not be okay. So there was just kind of a detachment in that parenting, which made it very difficult to feel secure and feel safe. And most of the time I didn't feel secure and safe. But I had a positive end to that story because when my parents finally did get a divorce, which divorce is not a good thing by any means, but at that time it was a good thing to be separated from my biological father. And my mother remarried years later to a military colonel who was the opposite of my dad. He was secure and loving and kind. So that kind of gave me a heart for kids from hard places. And I knew there was hope and healing because I had it. So I knew that other kids could have the same experience. So that led me to adoption.
Love that you can identify as a kid from a hard place who hasn't experienced adoption in the same way that our kiddos have. Because I think a lot of times we hear all this talk about hope and healing and kind of what our hearts need, and sometimes we dismiss it if, you know, we're not adopted or our kids aren't adopted. But I've said it before, it's just there's so many other things that register in kids' little hearts as trauma and traumatic experiences and make us kids from hard places. And so.
Right. And sometimes if we do not have the experience ourselves, it's just a bunch of words. And trying to explain to someone else what trauma does to the brain and how it raises cortisol levels in kids. And I was one of those kids whose cortisol levels had to be through the roof all the time. Unless you have experienced it yourself, it's very difficult to comprehend what these kids are going through. And so I have an understanding of what these kids are going through because I experienced it myself. Maybe not exactly the same as they did, but like you said, trauma is trauma. It affects your body, your brain, your biology, your makeup. And I was one of those kids with a failure to thrive. I didn't, my mother was constantly asking the pediatrician why my sister and I weren't growing. And now, you know, years later, I understand why we weren't growing, because we weren't secure and we weren't neurotypical. We had all of these issues that we see in our kids that we adopt through, like our kids were in an orphanage, through an orphanage or through an institution or through foster care. And that's the way that I was. So I have more of an understanding of that.
So yeah, that's amazing.
My day-to-day, okay, I just finished a 21-year career of homeschooling my children. This is the first year in 21 years that I'm not homeschooling because I'm finished.
Oh, my word. That must feel, is it amazing or are you really, really sad?
Both. It's first of all, it's been very, very weird. And some days I'm sad, and then some days I'm not. But I quickly moved into a new season of my life, which really filled up my time, because I get up in the morning and I write. So that filled my time, and I already had the discipline of getting up in the morning and doing my Bible study and then starting school. So now I get up in the morning and do my Bible study and start writing. And I have I only have one child left at home, but with seven children who are adulting and eight grandchildren and one on the way, my house is also like a giant revolving door because people are coming and going here all the time. I never know when someone's going to show up. In fact, we had to get a security system with the keypad entry so that I didn't have to be handing out keys left and right.
Oh, that's so funny.
And no, I'm not giving out the code because I have enough people coming over.
Oh, that's so funny. Are they all your people, or do you also have a revolving door for, like, community people and, like, other, like, pseudo-adoptees? Or, I mean, obviously you have 7 kids, and they all have kids, so you don't really need extras so much, but is it pretty much just your crew in and out?
No, actually, there's friends and extended family who also know the code. And we like to really practice my ministry is called The Whole House, which involves my niece Carly is on my team, my daughter Amory, and then a friend Lori Schaefer, who's our social media director. And we like to practice the habit of celebration, and we use my house for that. We have a monthly live coffee, and we invite a bunch of moms and their kids, and we have a topic of discussion. And we're just getting into trying to live stream some of it, but technology is not my thing, but I'm getting there. And we have a fall harvest day, and we just did a craft and cookie day, and we have a summer camp for 3 or 4 days in the summer. So we like to do a lot of the habit of celebration. So my life
That's
is
so
kind
fun.
Of-
I want to come be by you and have your code. That sounds like so much fun. so when you say you like get up every day and have your devotion and write, there's obviously a lot of other stuff going on. I was like picturing like all these like long serene days, but really, let's be honest, but I mean, there's probably a lot of interruptions.
There's a lot of interruptions. In fact, when I was going through your questions this morning and making some notes on some points I wanted to make, I have one daughter who came over to do her laundry and sitting there talking to me while I'm doing the notes, and one son who was just here having a conversation with both of us, kept coming in the room and leaving the room. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, constant. Oh, I wrote down this. My life is a kind of organized, blessed, messy, imperfect chaos. That's my life. And it's great.
Yeah, I bet it's so beautiful. So tell me more about this whole house.
I originally started the website myself, and at the time I started it, it was called Positive Adoption. And I write about adoption and foster care. I've done just tons and tons of research on fetal alcohol syndrome and the effects of that, and all of the capital letter syndrome. So I started out with writing a lot of just encouraging, equipping, and educating articles about that. And then as my kids started getting a little bit older, they wanted to participate. And my daughter, Audrey, who's my eldest daughter, she has 5 children of her own now. She was my web administrator, and she still helps with technical difficulties. But the purpose of the whole house and everyone on my team is to equip, educate, and encourage adoptive and foster families. And we also delve into a little bit of practicing motherhood, nurturing your children when it doesn't come naturally, and those sorts of topics that deal with the whole family. And the reason we changed the name of the website to The Whole House is because each member of my team has different gifts, and they have different passions. So it's kind of like what it talks about in the Bible, that we all are part of a body and we're different parts. Well, we were referencing a house because we're all part of the same house, but we represent different rooms. Like my daughter, Amory, her passion is to minister to young mothers about how to nurture your children and how to do sensory activities and all those sorts of things. And then my niece Carly, one of her passions is to end sex trafficking, and she's very into social issues. So we see that come out of her. But then my friend Lori, who just recently joined our team, she's our social media director, just because I need a kick in the butt most of the time to remember to post things on social media. But she has come alongside us because she has a special needs child. He has sensory processing disorder, and we became friends years ago, and she actually went through the Empowered to Connect training last year, and it has helped her son so much with the tools that she's learned, so she just wants to be a part of this. And she also, her room is, she was in an abusive marriage the first time around. So she has a heart for women who are abandoned and discarded and misused and abused. And she is in a very, she's been in a very loving and stable marriage for the past 16 years. And it's just coming out that she wants to minister to these women. So that's her room in the house. And, of course, my room in the house is adoption and foster care and writing about those issues. So that's what the whole house is. And we are starting a podcast. We have recorded about 8 of them, and we'll be releasing the first one on January 1st. And I'm kind of like you. I have my nephew, Gabe, who runs a podcast called Decent Christian Talk, helping me with doing the editing and all of that sort of stuff, because I'm clueless on all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, how exciting. I love that image of the house and the rooms and how you've kind of brought all these women and their gifts and their talents and all their amazing things into this project. And you've, you know, designed it and imagined it in such a way that there is space and room for all of these things. And, you know, as it morphs and changes and as God leads you, you know, you just have this beautiful umbrella of, you know, just space where he can work and the people that you can reach out to. And so fun.
Right.
So cool.
Right. And we do that. I love the umbrella picture because we're also a support for one another. And when I was going the website mostly alone, except for the technology help, I was just doing it by myself. And, you know, doing something alone when you're isolated and you don't know what you're doing can be very difficult.
Yeah. My motto is it's always better with friends.
Yes.
Everything.
I agree.
It's always better with friends. So, I want to pick your brain about fetal alcohol. That's totally not what we were talking about, but you said that my ears perked up because our youngest son from Korea, he's had all kinds of challenges over the years. He's been home for 8 or 9 years now. But we just came to the conclusion this summer, and he was officially diagnosed, that he more than likely was exposed in utero to alcohol, and that explains so many of his things that we could never really put our finger on before. And so I'm going to have to go back to those articles and kind of glean from your wisdom, because we've obviously been doing a lot of things that revolve around sensory, and, you know, we also went and were trained at Empowered to Connect as parent trainers, and so those tools are absolutely invaluable, but there's some nuances to fetal alcohol that we're just kind of getting our feet wet into, so... Any words
right.
of pearly words of wisdom for me?
Well, I would say that one of the most difficult things to comprehend about fetal alcohol syndrome is, you know, it damages the executive function of the brain. So there's a lot of logic that's missing and the cause and effect. And usually these children do not have the ability to grasp logic or math, which is part of logic. And so we parents sometimes go around the same mountain over and over and over again because we think, oh, he's just going to get it. He'll finally get it. And their brains are like Swiss cheese. And so my youngest had the most fetal alcohol syndrome. My other three had the fetal alcohol effects. So he would get a math concept and just like have it hammered down one day and be so excited. And then the next day it would be gone. And as parents, we have to remember that these kids are not doing it on purpose. And you know this because of Empowered to Connect training. But also that they are just as frustrated as we are. And our expectations can't be in the academics. Because if we set the bar so high for these kids with fetal alcohol syndrome with academics, then they're never, ever going to reach it. And the thing that we had to come to terms with our youngest son was he didn't go to college. He's 19, and he's working full-time at Walmart. But the fact that he can work full-time at Walmart is a major victory for him. That's what he can handle. That's the bar that he can reach. And so I would just say, to sum it up, my words of wisdom are, you know, lower the bar, lower your expectations, and don't expect them just to get it just because of repetition. Because we're often told that, you know, repetition, repetition. Yes, keep doing the repetition, but don't have high expectations for it and rejoice in those small victories. And that was a lot to say for one point.
I know. Well, I get, you know, my head gets a lot of it, and then my humanness is so frustrated sometimes. And I think I really struggle with that balance that you were just talking about, like to keep doing it but not have an expectation. And my background is engineering. I'm a very left-brained, logical person, and I always joke that, like, the most sanctifying thing that I could have ever done to two engineers, my husband and I, is to give us these four kids from hard places. And one who is fetal alcohol affected, because, like you said, like, logic doesn't apply. If I ever write my memoir, it's going to be something like, check your logic at the door.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
It's just, yeah, you know.
Two engineers and fetal alcohol syndrome, that's a very, very difficult combination.
I know. You can just imagine.
You rely on logic because that's your strength. And I'm sure that there's so many frustrating moments because you're looking at this child thinking, why doesn't he just put two and two together? And he does put two and two together, and he gets five one day, and he gets seven the next day. And once in a while, he might get four, but it might just be a fluke, too.
Right.
Because often people think that these children will grow out of brain damage because alcohol damages the brain. And I'm sure you've been online and looked at all the wonderful photos of what a brain looks like after it's been exposed to too much alcohol, and it's shrunken and split more in the middle than it should be. And those parts of the brain can't be restored. And that's the one thing we have to remember when we're talking about hope and healing. Yes, there's hope and healing and feeling safe and feeling secure, but we have to realign our expectations for these kids who have that permanent brain damage. And we need to be able to grieve about it first. And we often don't allow ourselves to grieve about it and say, you know what, I had this picture in my mind of what this child's life would be like, and it's not going to be that way because it can't be that way. But it can still be wonderful and beautiful. It just won't be the way that I thought it would be.
Yeah, the ironic part of this whole, of his particular story and our adoption story is we adopted him knowing that he had special needs, but they were very much unknown special needs. And so we had very much shored ourselves up for a specific set of special needs that people had kind of guesstimated would be the story of his life. And so in some ways, you know, we weren't blindsided by the fact that he had special needs. They just didn't look anything like we had expected. And so it has been a very interesting journey. And, you know, even just the fact that he's been home for 8 or 9 years and we're finally just putting our finger on what, you know, is probably his core diagnosis has made it really hard to kind of wrap our minds around kind of what we were dealing with. And, of course, the engineer in me needs to wrap my mind around it and needs to order it and make sense of it rather than kind of just kind of going with the flow, which would probably make all of our lives so much easier, but so is life.
Right, and I understand that too, because our youngest, we knew it was very similar to your story. We knew he had special needs, and we saw what they were on paper. He had a cleft palate, and he had a hole in his heart, and he was very developmentally delayed. So we knew those things, but we didn't understand the extent of the other issues. In fact, the fetal alcohol syndrome, we didn't realize how much it would affect him. And we also didn't realize how much the 17 months of no loving touch in first being born prematurely and being abandoned at the hospital and all of those issues that come with that, never having any loving touch. He has probably, because I'm thinking, okay, he's a toddler. He's 17 months old. This one is going to be the easy one. You know, the other three were 7, 6, and 4, and we could see some of the emotional scars very clearly, and we thought, you know, we're really going to work with these guys, but this little one, he's just going to come right along. And no, that wasn't the way it worked. And actually, he got some other diagnoses when he was 15 because he was having some other issues, and he also has Asperger's, and he has processing disorders. So, yeah, I understand that finding out later and trying to make sense of it and trying to figure out how to proceed from there.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm going to back up just a little bit. You told your story about how you identify and how your identity of an adopted daughter of God kind of led you to the next logical step, which was participating and to be an adoptive family. What did that look like for your husband? When you guys got married, were you already having that identity and knowing, I know that I want adoption to be part of our family story? Is that something that came later? Did he come along willingly? Was he a draggy, as sometimes we like to call them? How did that look for you guys?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, and I'll get into some of my husband's parents' story in a minute because it fits in. But when Jerry and I got married, we had already decided, we had already had the discussion that someday we would adopt. And so there was a teenage mother, she was 13, who very early in our marriage, we'd only been married a couple of years, and she wrote us a letter and asked us if we would adopt her child. And she was actually staying with my sister as part of one of those programs where you can take in teen mothers and you nurture them and stay with them. And that's what my sister is doing. So we said yes. And then it turned out after she had the baby, she changed her mind. And so we said, well, we're still going to adopt. We're just going to put it on hold for a while. And we did. So we had 3 biological children and then decided to pursue the process. And my husband is from Poland, so that's why we decided on Poland. And his family has a rich Polish heritage. And here is the interesting thing. Yes, my husband came along very willingly, and he was very excited about the process and enlarging our family because we wanted to have a very large family. And I had a lot of really bad complications with pregnancies. So after 3, that was not an option anymore to have children that way. So he was ready to enlarge our family a lot, like I was. But we were very afraid to tell his parents, especially my parents were just, we knew that they would be fine with that. And actually, my mother had already died before we started the adoption process, but she would have been just overjoyed about it. But we were really afraid to tell Jerry's parents, especially his dad, because Jerry's dad just seems to, he's one of those guys that has a really hard exterior, but you know there's softness in there, and you're trying to find it. So very interesting thing. Once we adopted the children, then Jerry Sr., my father-in-law, tells me one day, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood in an orphanage. And I said, what? Like, I had never known this. So part of his healing came with us adopting children because he began to rehearse his past and share it with me more than anybody, and make sense of it himself. So our adopting children became part of his healing, and that I think that's just such an amazing thing.
Wow, I just love when stories come like full circle like that and written in ways that only God can orchestrate. It's just so cool.
Right, because my husband didn't even know all of his dad's past. He didn't know about his dad being in an orphanage and being passed from family member to family member and then back into the orphanage again until finally an uncle came and took him out of the orphanage when he was 15 years old and then just finished raising him.
Wow. So let's circle back to your morning routine that includes your devotion time and then writing. So what have you been writing? And just tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, my parents were both in the English education world. And actually, my degree is in math and education, so I don't know why I did that, but I did. but I've been writing sporadically since I was a child. My mother was a writer who published many articles in Catholic publications, and my dad is still a writer, and he writes for the New Oxford Review and the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and he's written for the Washington Post, and he sent me a really long list today, and I won't read it all. So I was like, Dad, what have you written in? But he has a doctorate in English.
Wow.
So it's just kind of, you know, I had a lot of example in that area, put it that way. But my first book, Positive Adoption, a memoir, which is a combination of my story and the story of my children's adoption plus a bit of theology, took me 12 years to write simply because I was homeschooling.
Simply because you had 7 children that you were homeschooling. I think that's pretty much sums it up.
Right. Well, and I would write bits and pieces at swim practice or play practice and, you know, just take these notebooks all over the place and write every time I got a chance. And then I finally had to make some sense of it and put it into chapters and put it together. So that was published in February of 2015. And this year has been a year of writing for me since I'm not homeschooling, and I've had the opportunity to take that discipline I learned homeschooling and apply it to writing. So I've written and released 3 books this year. The first one is 5 Things, a Tiny Handbook for Adoptive and Foster Families. And I actually created that little handbook. And you can, if people sign up to follow thewholehouse.org, they can get that book for free in a PDF format. And then I wrote 25 Days of Thriving Through Christmas and Advent Devotional for Adoptive and Foster Parents. And I'm doing a book discussion online with that book through the month of December. And then my latest release is Defining Home, and that's the first novel. I've always been really strong in writing nonfiction. When I say strong, that's where I feel comfortable. That doesn't mean I'm the best writer in the world. That's just where I feel comfortable writing. That's where my parents wrote. They were, you know, they were that kind of writer. But I decided I wanted to write this novel to raise awareness about sex trafficking, the epidemic, especially as it pertains to orphans. And can I tell you a little bit about that? I know you've read the book, but can
yeah, I got to read a preview copy and review it for you. It was really fun. I love to be able to do that for people, and you know, and I love free stuff, and I love reading, and so it all fits together. But yeah, I'd love for you to tell the listeners kind of what that's all about.
Right. And by the way, Melissa's review is on the back of the book, so just to let you know.
Yay, my, like, 15 minutes of fame. Woohoo!
So, the main character, her name's Adelina, and she's a teen, and she has this inner struggle. She doesn't know what the definition of home really means because she's never had a safe and secure home. She's about to age out of the system, and this whole book takes place in Poland. And it's actually interesting enough, and I probably butcher all the Polish words, but I wanted to write it about Poland because all the places in the book are places that I've been. The orphanage that I use is the same orphanage that 3 of my children came from in Slajów. And like I said, I'm probably butchering that because I'm not Polish and my husband's not here to say it. So just that little note that all those places are real, all those places I've been to. So she has Adelina has a best friend named Daria, and Daria is about to get adopted, and this adoption fails, and all of a sudden Daria disappears, and Adelina is the only one who thinks there's something fishy going on because Daria had been meeting this strange, mysterious boyfriend. So Adelina begins this journey of trying to find her friend alone, and she enters into a really dangerous world of intrigue and she just has no idea where to trust, who to trust, or what to do. And the thing about one of the reasons I wrote this is, and I'm not going to tell you anymore because I want you to get the book and read it for yourself, but orphans are prime target for sex traffickers. And one of my friends who has a radio show in New York called Orphans No More, her children are adopted from the Ukraine, and she was telling me that in the Ukraine there, when these girls are aging out of the system, there's sex traffickers right outside the door. When they leave the orphanage, they just take them. So these things that I'm writing about are true, and they are common events.
Yeah, which is absolutely horrifying.
Yes, it is. And I wanted to write the book for teens so that teens would be aware, and I even include in the back of the book some resources and some tips for things for kids to watch for themselves, because unfortunately, it's also an epidemic in the United States, and a lot of teens who are middle class and bored and goofing around on the internet are being taken because they're talking to the wrong people and meeting the wrong people. So I just wanted to add that because I think there's a misconception that it's always just in other countries and it's always just poor people, and that's not true at all.
Yeah, education is such a powerful part of the solution for this because of all of those misconceptions. And I actually, at least for a time, and possibly still true today, Baltimore, which is the nearest big city to where we live, is one of the most trafficked cities in the country because we're so close. We're right in between New York and D.C. We're on a port. There are many, many professional sports teams in a close radius. And unfortunately, the professional sports industry is one of the largest funders of that sex trade in our country. And so because we're right on 95 and there's so many different ways to get in and out of our city, that makes it a really prime, easy way to do all of those horrific things. And it is such a big deal, super relevant, still happening. So I was really captivated by that theme in your book because I do know that this is a big deal. It's, you know, and that more people need to be made aware. And it was a quick read, and it wasn't, I mean, not fun because it was a hard topic, but there were lighthearted moments, and the characters were very relatable, and I don't know, I really enjoyed it. So thanks for letting me be a part of that.
That was one of my goals, was to, first of all, make it short enough that a teenager would read it. You know what I mean? Because it's something that they could pick up and read. In fact, a couple of the teens on my revision team read it in 2 days. Which is, you know, quick for a teen, and an adult could read it in a couple hours. And that's one of the reasons I made it that short. And also, like I was saying, the events and the characters and the people, I based those all on true events. I did a lot of research, and then I just interweaved other people's stories from and put them into those characters. So it would feel, because I've never written a novel before, and I wanted it to feel like they were real people.
Yeah. So do you self-publish your books? What's your, editing and publishing process look like?
My editing and publishing process has changed greatly this year. Like, the first book that I wrote, my daughter's degree, my daughter Audrey, my oldest daughter, her degree is also in English, and she used to work for the local newspaper. And so she did the editing of the first book, and I just edited, and I used CreateSpace to publish, and then publish on Amazon. But this time I changed a little bit, so I do still self-publish because I love owning the intellectual rights. I love having the control. I love deciding when I want to publish. But I did this time develop some teams for revision for the novel team. I had a revision team, and it went through several revisions because it's just not something I was comfortable doing. And I've done revision teams for my other nonfiction books also. And then I did have to have a couple proofreaders because my daughter is too busy with her children right now. And I also used CreateSpace, but I also used a program called Vellum to do my formatting, which saved me a lot of time. And one thing that people don't often understand about self-publishing is it's not cheating or taking the easy way out. It's taking the creative process and making it your own and putting the content out that you would like to put out And my books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Alibris and Books A Million and any major bookseller you can order my book. So if I'm just saying that in case someone's sitting there thinking, I'd like to write a book, well, you can. And you can own the whole creative process. Just get a really good team of people around you to help you. And like the other thing I did differently this time was I had pre-read teams, and you were on that pre-read team because you either answered an email or I don't even know. Was it on the Empower to Connect training page?
It might have been. Yeah.
Who wants to read this book and review it? So.
Yeah, that very well may have been it. So, well, I'm so impressed by. I'm really just impressed by authors. I do. It's on my bucket list to write a book, but I don't know, just like everything else in life, I have a short attention span, so I feel like I've been a blogger for years, and so I feel like that's, like, I can write a blog post that's about my attention span. So, like, the idea of, like, thinking about a book, the theme of it, you know, like, the continuity that you need to kind of get from point A to point B, and my life is so, like, my moments of time to think are so fragmented that's, like, as best that I can do is, you know, like 300 words or whatever. But I'm like that with other things too, like exercise and running. Like, you know, I don't run like marathons. I run like, you know, 50-foot dashes, you know, like give me just a little bit of exercise at a time. I don't need to like do the whole thing. But I get really curious when other people start talking about writing, and I take notes and tuck them in the back of my head for, you know, that one day I'll pull myself together maybe and write a book.
Well, and you're right, because the thing is, writing is requires a lot of thought. And I think I do a lot of my pre-writing is just my thought process. And when I finally get down to, in fact, right before this interview, I was working on novel number 2 about Adelina, and I'm just making all kinds of weird random notes all over a piece of paper that will eventually become the plot. So, yeah, it is a sporadic thing. But it is also, being a writer means that you're going to spend a lot of time alone. And like I said, I wrote my first book at different practices and stuff like that. But when it got right down to the process, it's, you know, you're alone, which is fine with me because I'm an introvert. So.
Yeah, I think I might need to have a co-author. I'd probably need to, like, talk a book out or something. And I think that's the other problem is I think the process, I forget that the process is kind of messy like that, where it just starts off with, like, scribbles. And I kind of want to, like, spit out a book. And so it, like, rolls around in my head. And so I think I just need to give myself permission to start just randomly writing thoughts and pieces and all of those things, because in my head I want to just, you know, kind of spit. I mean, I know there's an editing process and all of those things, but I want to spit out like a 90% done book and then go back and, like, you know, rearrange a couple sentences and dot a couple I's and cross a couple T's. So that's like the perfectionist in me coming out. I think I need to probably get over that.
I understand that completely, yes. And you can't, when you are writing, you can't be thinking about editing at the same time. You just need to let it come out. Yep.
So, well, that's so fun. I have some wrap-up questions. I sent you 2 of them. I've come up with a 3rd one, but it shouldn't be that hard. So my first one that I sent you was, you know, talk about a story that has affected you and kind of changed the course of your life. And so we talked a little bit about some of those pieces, you know, your father-in-law story and those kinds of things. But is there anything else that kind of jumps out at you where getting to know someone and their story helped to shape kind of your worldview?
Yes. My mother's story affected me. She was a child from a hard place, and she didn't have a great childhood at all. And I won't go, you know, that's her personal story, and even though she's in heaven, I won't be sharing all of that. But despite the fact that she came from a very difficult childhood, she built a really strong family unit. And her compassion because of her childhood led her to move us to West Virginia after my stepfather retired from the military and opened a food pantry and clothes closet serving the needs of the people. So my mother was a Mother Teresa of sorts. And it took me a while. My mother's been gone for over 21 years. And it took me for a while after she died to figure out that I didn't need to lead her life and her dream, because I worked, I helped at the food pantry. And I realized that that was her dream and her vision, and I had my own. But her story really helped me to lead my story and begin that journey into adoption.
That's pretty amazing. It's always fascinating, those kind of generational things that cycle through and how it affects where we take our lives and what those paths are in those journeys. So thanks for sharing that. My next question is the one that I'm sneaking in on you, but I started this kind of theme in some of my social media in December and on the blog, and the theme is kind of what I'm not doing. I feel like social media is sometimes a really frustrating place, especially for adoptive families, because I don't know about your kids, but our kids really struggle at the holidays. I feel like as an adult adoptee, I struggle at the holidays, and I've never really fully unpacked why that is, but I don't love the holidays. I think a lot of it's just the interruption of the general flow of life, and I'm really a routine kind of girl. But, we get on social media and we see lots of happy, smiling faces, and we, just imagine that all of these people that are posting, that's the representation of their lives. Or, we talk to people who, amazing women like you, who parent 7 children and homeschool them and write at the same time. And we think, like, I just can't do it all, and I can't do what she's doing, and I don't, I'm not as cool as her, and all these other things. And so I am running a holiday survival support group currently. This will air after the holidays, but we're recording in December, and I had this, thought one day, and I got on, and I was like, guys, what are you not doing? And I shared some of the things that I wasn't doing, like cleaning and homeschooling. We are a homeschooling family, but I've been ignoring those things for a couple weeks. And, not doing laundry and not cooking dinner for my family and all of these things. And it just was so well received. It was so freeing for everyone to say, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you're not doing those things. Like, here's the list of things that I'm not doing right now. And so it's kind of become a theme. And so my question to you is, what are you not doing? Because we know a lot of the things that you are doing, but what are you not doing?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm just going to say that's why what you're talking about the holidays, is why I wrote 25 Days Thriving Through Christmas, an Advent devotional for foster and adoptive parents, because so many kids struggle. And so I'm running that book discussion, and we are talking about some of the same kind of things that you're talking about right now. And so I think that's very interesting. God has us doing very similar things because people have this need. And I think that one of the things that I'm not doing is I feel the freedom to not do everything, because I know that I don't need to do everything. And yes, you're saying, you sound like a wonderful person and like you're super busy, but I keep my margins very wide. And by that I mean, if, like tonight, I did not cook dinner. I ate yogurt for dinner, and that's okay. And sometimes just saying, I choose to do this because I need the peace, I need the rest, and I don't need to be overwhelmed with the dinner cleanup. And one of the things that I used to do in December when I was homeschooling was we would just take that whole month off. It was just too much. It was too much for my kids because we were going to drama practices and choir practices and some of those things that I would choose to do and other things I chose not to do. So I say that, I think it's really important, and I do this, is just use the freedom to choose to say no to things, to say no to as many things as you want to say no to, because you're answering to God, you're not answering to people. And if you get so overwhelmed that your whole life is frustrating, then you need to sit down and reevaluate and see what you can cut out. So I'm not doing everything. That's my answer.
That's good. I love that. That's comforting to know. So last question, what is a life hack you have? So you're a mama of 7 kids. There's got to be some shortcuts or some other things that you could impart to me and to everyone listening. But, you know, what are you doing that could help a mama out?
Okay, one of my favorite life hacks that I've been using for 20 years is a whiteboard in the dining room, a whiteboard calendar, and a plain whiteboard. Because one of the things that kids with hard places struggle with is schedule. They need a tight schedule. They need everything to be organized for them. They need to know what is happening next. So I use the calendar to write events on, and I refer to it often. And I also use the whiteboard to write out the daily schedule so that kids could look at it and say, oh, that's what we're doing today, instead of following me around saying, what are we doing today? What are we doing today? What are we doing today? And also for those children who struggle with the control issue, they want to be in control of everything. If it's written on the whiteboard, vacuum your room, then they can stand there and argue with the whiteboard all they want.
And that's so great.
And the kid would come to me and say, the whiteboard, so you know, it says that we have to do this. Well, then you have to do it.
Right.
So that just like, kind of relieves.
It's like your personal assistant.
Right.
Well, the whiteboard says.
Yes, the whiteboard says. So that's my life hack.
Oh, that's a good one. I have a kid who's not from a hard place who thrives on just knowing what's ahead. I always joke and say that, you know, with enough notice, he would lick a trash can clean for you. Like, you know, he just has to have it on his calendar, and he's such a great, willing kid. But, man, if you ask him to just do something simple, like take the trash out, like without notice, World War III could totally erupt in my house. And it took us a while to kind of understand that about him, and so, you know, now we can mitigate it as best we can, of course. But, yeah, that, like, knowing ahead of time that having something to refer to without having to answer the same question, you know, 5 million times a day is big.
Exactly.
And in our house, we have extended family living with us. So we actually have 3 family units in our house and tucked into different corners. And so I find myself, like, talking to adults about things that are going on that include the entire family. We, you know, there's a couple things that we do all together. And, you know, I might talk to my mom about it, and then I might talk to my sister about it, and then, you know, maybe I'll talk to my 14-year-old about it or something. And I just feel like I've had the conversation about, you know, when we're going to go get our Christmas tree or whatever. The Christmas tree we're not getting this
right.
year, but something like that. And I've, like, you know, had that conversation umpteen times. And so then, you know, the dawn of the day arrives, and, you know, we're like, let's go get the Christmas tree. And my husband's like, what? You didn't tell me we were going to do that. And I'm like, surely we had that conversation. He's like, no. And I'm like, I know I told you. And then I'll, like, start, you know, rolling back, and I'll be like, you know what? Maybe I didn't. I just felt like I had talked about it so often to so many people that clearly I had talked to you. Surely I had had to have talked to you, but sure enough, maybe I didn't. So that happens often in our family where I've left someone out because I've had the conversation at least a half a dozen times, and I just figure everyone had to have listened to it by then.
Right, and that's when you could say, it's on the whiteboard.
I know. We share a calendar. We're techie people. We do share, like, a calendar. It shows up on both of our phones, but, you know, that would require it to be looked at, so that doesn't always happen.
Exactly. Right.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your heart and your story and your family and all the things that you're doing. And I kind of feel like I want to say that's awesome, that because we're doing some of the same things, and so that feels very validating to me. So I'm excited about that. And
about that too, because I think that God is amazing how He's having you run that support group and me run the book discussion, because we're filling that need And first of all, it was a need in our own lives, or we wouldn't even have been aware of it. And then we're stepping forward and saying, hey, let's fill that need in somebody else's life now. And I think some of the most powerful words that I'm going to say, what Emily Dickinson said was, you know, just me too, you know. And that's what we're, and I think that's why we have that connection with each other, because we're just like, me too. Yeah, me too. It's not just you, it's me too.
Yeah, so much solidarity there. Well, thank you so much for staying up late and taking some time out of your quiet night to hang out and chat with me. I'll be looking for that podcast when it comes out after the first of the year, and keep me posted about your book. We'll definitely share that with the listeners and the blog readers and all those things when it's available for purchase.
It is available. It was available December 1st.
Oh, it was. I missed it. Gosh.
Yep.
Okay. Well, perfect. I will get a link to that on the show notes page. And your blog is
thewholehouse.org.
Okay. So I'll definitely put that on the show notes page so people can find it there. And are you hanging out on social media anywhere else? Are there other places that people can find you?
Yes. On Instagram is the_whole_house.org. And on Facebook, I have a community page called The Whole House.
All right. Well, we will definitely get all of those up. Oh, one more?
Well, just me. I'm just Kathleen Guire on Facebook, and I probably remember to post on that more than anything. So you can follow me there, too.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, again, thank you so much, and I look forward to continuing to follow you and see what you're up to.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. I think Kathleen convinced me to start writing my book. Well, at least the part where you scribble thoughts that won't make sense to anyone, and hopefully will still make sense to me when I finally get to pull the whole thing together. Those words, discipline and homeschooling, they don't go together in my world quite the same as they seem to in Kathleen's world. So if her first book took 12 years to write, you can probably look for mine in about 25. I'm also going to put those reminders she gave about fetal alcohol syndrome on repeat every morning on my phone before I get my youngest up. I'll have links for Kathleen's book, Defining Home, and her social media and the self-publishing tool she mentioned, as well as a really cool video about police dogs who can sniff out electronics. This is huge in the battle against trafficking, since pimps often hide digital evidence in their houses. That evidence has often gone unfound before the introduction of these canines. She also mentioned that one of the gals on her Whole House team came out of an abusive relationship. If that's the room in Kathleen's house that you connect with, check out episode 2 with Bethany Kesmerick. She has a beautiful story that inspired a phenomenal novel, so I'll put a link to that too on the show notes page. As always, the show notes page for the podcast can always be found at www.thequirkums.com. If you want to connect more about parenting kids from hard places, I started a YouTube channel this week. It's a channel of connected parenting lessons, so just search for Essentially Connected Parenting on the YouTube homepage. I'm also on social media at M.A. Corkum on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and I'd love to hear from you about parenting or just feedback about the podcast. Lastly, please take a second to give a thumbs up on Stitcher or rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It really helps more people get to hear some of these great stories. Next week, I'll have a guest all the way from Australia, so stay tuned.